in this very broad area of the United States, Salish was the primary language spoken for thousands and thousands of years. And it's not anymore.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Lauren Korn, introducing Heather Cahoon, author of the poetry collection Horsefly Dress. Heather is the director of the American Indian Governance and Policy Institute at the University of Montana in Missoula. She is from the Flathead Reservation and is a member of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. First of all, thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, I'm excited. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm anxious to dive into Horsefly Dress, and I'm hoping you're willing to first read a poem from the book before we kind of begin our conversation. Will you read the poem that introduces readers to Horsefly Dress, that titular poem?
Yes, I would love to. So like you noted, the title is Horsefly Dress. A long wing feather propels the stunted body of a black-crowned night heron through air, breaking apart the dried mouth of memory. In an outpouring of primordial story, I hear her name, Chatinalx, the hunting moon unearths Coyote's eldest and only daughter. Her name no longer spoken, she turned to porous stone, but I hear her name, Chatinalx, along Flathead River near Rive, in the cutting of meat, its crackle drying above smoldering cottonwood. Chatinalx, at the edge of river, in passing water, the embodiment of belief, she perforates the divide between known and unknown. Here, she reconsiders the archaeology of our suffering. Her mouth opens in the alarm cry of a brown thrasher, a warning, brace for all, that's wrapped into a name.
Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to Coyote and Coyote's daughter, Horsefly Dress?
Yeah, I love Horsefly Dress. I heard several Coyote stories growing up, you know, definitely not like the exhaustive canon of those stories. But you hear them, they have winter storytelling events, or, you know, somebody just tell you one. So I just heard different ones. But I think I was tuned in a little bit to like, oh, Sinchetle and Pulia have children. But I never wondered about them until I heard, oh, Coyote, Sinchetle has a daughter. Her name is Chatinalx. Her name is Horsefly Dress. And I literally was like, what? Coyote has a daughter? Well, where is she in all of these stories? I began looking for her in those stories. And like I've said in prior interviews, it was in seeking her out in those stories that I finally like understood how they function and these enormous life lessons that are contained in these stories. I just never could discern that before until I became like a scholar or a student of the stories. I feel like there's a lot of similarities between us in terms of we both have fathers who are very strong characters, very much play like the main character role in our lives and in the lives of our families and also big families. I have a lot of brothers. She has a lot of brothers. You know, there was just so many different similarities. And in the stories, she's sort of the antithesis of her father. And I should clarify that that's probably like where the similarities between her relationship with her dad and my relationship with my dad ends. My dad and I are very close. But so back to her and her in the stories, you know, she's very pragmatic. She's very loyal. She's caretaking her brothers. She caretakes her father. She's never all of those things that Coyote is so well known for. He's outrageous. she is not outrageous. She's just like this stable, functional person. She does have a role in some very big roles in the stories that I, you know, hadn't been aware of in terms of creating circumstances that solidified, for example, the reason that death is permanent. And, you know, all of these things, so that she plays a big role in creating and transforming the world, but definitely second to Coyote.
So before this first poem in the collection, you begin the book with an epigraph. It's a quote by the poet Ted Hughes from his book, Wolf Watching. "The cry you dare not cry in these moments will last you a lifetime." Many of the figures in your book cry or emit cries, and the collection seems like a material or tangible recognition of suffering and danger and death in the collection, these instances specifically of crying. How and when do you cry?
Wow. I don't know if anybody has ever asked me that. You know, I don't often cry. I feel like the closest I come to crying is when I feel emotionally moved by something very beautiful or meaningful. But it's been a really long time since I've cried out of despair. The process of writing this book is sort of embodies the process I went through of working through various instances of grief and seeing the alternative to being so challenged by those instances. And so as a young child, as a church-going child, I understood that suffering was a negative thing. It was painful. It was warranted always on some level, having a trigger that was connected to a sin or some, you know, ill behavior or, you know, somehow the human had invoked the wrath of God, and the consequence was that feeling of suffering. You know, but there's a lot of instances where that trigger is absent. You know, for example, like when children are born into war or somebody is stricken with a life-threatening illness or, you know, that type of thing where the trigger is invisible there is no trigger. So I had several encounters that I write about in the book with those kinds of instances of suffering where there wasn't really a trigger. And it wasn't until I was a young adult that I was introduced to the Salish and Kalispel perspective on suffering, which was completely opposite of what I had sort of harbored in my psyche and in my body as, you know, a young person and going through, you know, adolescenthood. And that perspective was really that suffering was not something to be avoided. There was no questioning. There was no, you know, seeking out the why of suffering or trying to avoid its triggers. But suffering was perceived to be an integral part of the sacred, specifically for its the transformative powers that were associated with suffering. You know, it was just like a very, very different perspective. And I feel like since then, I don't feel compelled to feel despair. And I feel like, you know, crying in that way is I don't have a use for that, I think, now.
I guess I want to kind of stay on this thread of suffering. In a poem you titled Rilke, Screech Owl, and Night Loons, you cite Rilke when you write, quote, "If all art is the result of one's having been in danger, what is created when a girl walks beaten and burned for 4 miles before collapsing into stillness?" And this book seems, again, kind of proof that that sentiment is sort of true, given that it is a piece of art and there is suffering and danger in these pages. But in that line, there seems to be kind of a cynicism of that idea. How do you view danger and art, or danger and poetry?
These are very good questions. How do I view art and poetry and danger? Well, I guess maybe I'll start with the sort of response I had to that Rilke quote. So it came out of Letters on Cezanne, and it's sort of like a diary of Rainer Maria Rilke. And in it, he writes, while he's gazing at a Paul Cezanne painting, he says, "Surely all art is the result of one's having been in danger." I mean, I think that that is sort of the fuel that instigates people to create a way to express what they're feeling or what they've experienced. You know, in terms of where it is at in that poem, and that the girl that I'm referencing in the poem was a Crow girl that in my job as a policy analyst, I had to meet with tribal governments around the state. One of the executive officers from the Crow tribe told me about that, and it was in the context of missing and murdered Indigenous women. And, you know, I was just really thinking about these instances of suffering and what is created and what comes out of it. And, you know, can I pull that into my art, to my writing? And if so, you know, to what end? And ultimately, there's several instances, MMIW instances in my book. So really in the first half, maybe the first two thirds of the book, there's all sorts of poems that talk about being in danger or feeling like you're in danger, and the risk, the sorrow, the grief, just all of those things. And what I ultimately decided was I wanted to include all of those instances in my art, in my writing, and then look back through with that very unique and I think very empowering perspective on the role and purpose of suffering, you know, that I learned as a young adult from partly from our stories about horsefly dress, coyote stories, but also from some of our elders. And it really shifts how you think about the things that you have been through. The book shifts towards the end to also encompass and talk about another aspect of Salish and Kalispell philosophical beliefs, which is rebirth, how we are reborn, how we're transformed because of these different kinds of experiences. So I wanted to offer that to anybody, to any reader, to any audience, as a useful and interesting way to consider the things that grieve us the most.
Many of your poems include words from the Salish vocabulary, and you even include a glossary at the end of your book. Why include a glossary?
I think it's, you know, partly for accessibility. I was asked about that previously, where they said if your audience, you know, is primarily your own community, why include translations? And it's largely because most people in my tribal community don't speak Salish. So that was one reason. And then also another reason was it was actually feedback from one of the readers during the peer review process for publication that would be helpful to just compile all of those words and those definitions, those translations in a glossary versus, you know, noting them somewhere on the page where the poem was. And so it sort of consolidated them. But like I said, it's also just basic desire to let more people have access to those meanings.
Yeah, and I think there's a part of me that wants to respond to that with the idea of these poems kind of as an act of language reclamation. If so many people in the Salish communities don't actually speak the language, then there is kind of an act of reclamation, yeah?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, just putting those words back out into space where in this very broad area of the United States, Salish was one of the only languages, the primary language spoken for thousands and thousands of years. And it's not anymore. And so I feel like putting those words out there and having people saying those sound vibrations, like how is that different than English in this space? So I wanted to put it out there for those reasons also.
In your two-part poem, The Coyote and the Cross, you write, "I count the breaths between bodies, each syllable thrust from the chest." What happens in those breaths? What is lost in translation of those words, and what might be gained in translation?
You know, for my PhD, I studied very in-depth federal Indian policy as it has impacted tribal sovereignty. And so I had a lot of just in-depth hands-on learning and research about settler colonialism. And when I was in those circles where that was like the focus of dialogue, what is settler colonialism? Why don't Americans view themselves as settlers? You know, just all of these big questions. And also, in some regard, it seemed like at that time, every ill that is experienced by American Indians today can be traced back to either to some part of colonialism, loss of land, loss of language, federal policies of assimilation and acculturation, you know, the outlawing of tribal spiritual beliefs and practices, just this other side of American history that's sort of not really known. It's not taught in our schools. I was in the middle of all of that. You know, people were really talking about decolonization. How do we decolonize our governing structures and our, you know, all of these different things. So that I wrote that poem that talks about, you know, was it really that one point in history that triggered suffering in our communities? Or was it before that? Or was it sometime after that? Or has suffering, instances of suffering, always been here? You know, and I wanted to put that question out there, not to say that colonialism has benefited American Indians in any way or at all, or, you know, not to take a stance on that, but to just offer that question out there. So that poem was about that, and I count the breaths between bodies, each syllable thrust from the chest. So the lines after that trace my lineage of my father to his mother, to her father, to his mother, to her father, who was actually one of our medicine people named Hollicks, who foresaw the coming of the Black Robes or the Jesuits and Christianity and all of that. And so all of that is, you know, sort of was in my mind when I wrote that poem. And the last two lines, there's a little couplet that ends that poem that says, but even before that, the forest stood smoldering, apparitions with arms raised toward the sky.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with poet and scholar Heather Cahoon, author of Horsefly Dress. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You launched and now direct the American Indian Governance and Policy Institute here at the University of Montana. And how does your work as a scholar or as a professor, researcher, as the director of the Institute, how does that inform your poetry? And alternatively, does your poetry rather suffer from that work?
Well, I think that so far it's been sort of symbiotic. Some of the poems that I've written, like the one that I mentioned, the Rilke one, was actually based on my outreach to tribal governments as part of my job. It was actually a prior job. A lot of that same type of work and that same outreach and those relationships carried over into my current job as a professor and director of the Policy Institute. Yeah, so I feel like that work finds its way into my poetry, and not necessarily poetry, but creativity finds its way into my policy work, especially research. And right now I'm working on a project that is seeking to identify and articulate and structure the social determinants of health that are unique to life on reservations, especially in the state of Montana. And so I feel like that's like a very big process to conduct that research, do all of that reading, and then internalize it mentally and sort of re-articulate it in a in a framework that can be useful to tribal governments in terms of policy creation to address these needs. So yeah, I feel like there's a lot of creativity and I guess thoughtfulness that comes from poetry or from writing poetry and is useful to me in my day job.
Can you talk a little bit about the mission of the Institute? It sounds like it's a very collaborative structure in that you're working with other tribes, but also just kind of helping.
Helping is like the key phrase or key word there. It's designed to be helpful in assisting tribal governments with tribal level policy creation. And I created it partly because, you know, in my prior work as a policy analyst, I was doing research on state level policies that impacted tribal governments or tribal members on and off reservations. And, you know, that was, I think, the first time that I got like insights into how other levels of government work. You know, my PhD research was largely in federal Indian policy. So I understood, you know, some of that structure, but I definitely did not know anything about how state government worked. And when I was working as a policy analyst on that state level policy, I just saw like, oh my God, there's a legislative services division that has a staff of researchers, people who are doing what I'm doing, but they're doing it for legislators. You know, they're basically digging up data and really useful information to create accurate pictures to give to the people who are making decisions on our future. So it's called informed policymaking. Besides policy analysts, there's bill drafters, there's attorneys, you know, there's this whole staff of people basically who are there to be useful to legislators. And I thought, this is a good idea. This is what tribal governments should have access to as well. There's a lot of really complicated issues in Indian country. And while tribal governments all have general counsel, you know, they all have attorneys who work for them, they don't have that research staff who can just pull data. And there's also, you know, an issue with the availability of data and issues with data sovereignty and who controls the data on American Indians. So there's, you know, all those side issues too, but basically, I thought it would be very useful to give tribal governments access to a bunch of researchers who are employed within the Montana University system, who are professional level researchers who can dig up data. But also, I understand that people from outside a community or people who are removed from an issue are going to make bad policy judgments. And so in order to craft recommendations or to really get, you know, the full picture and adequate information to turn over to tribal councils and tribal business committees, you really need to partner with those communities and listen to what they say, you know, is informing these issues. So yeah, it's very collaborative. I'm just in the beginning phases right now. I'm conducting a tribal public policy needs assessment, which has been a little bit postponed and slightly derailed periodically because of COVID. Yeah, so I'm right now just looking for what are the main issues in tribal communities that they would like to have more data on, more research on these issues and policy analysis and development.
If you don't mind, Heather, I'm going to ask you to read one of the longer poems. Can you read Meditations on Blue for us?
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite poems.
Oh, it was one of my absolute favorites, too.
Meditations on Blue. Open as sky, as belief, my son's eyes as a child, before they shifted to earth-grounded hues of tufted hair grass, golden star moss and devil's club leaves. 6 mountain bluebirds frozen in space but not time with the help of the wild wind. Against the blonde hillside, they appear as if in a still life, as if I could walk up and pluck one from mid-air. Fireflies, like blue-white micro stars, blink on off near my father's house on Post Creek. Quickly, they disappear into the dark mouth of night. An emotion described, as in she or he is feeling blue. An idiom incapable of posing the questions cried by those it depicts. If crisis truly carries opportunity, what of the recursive nature of loss? Where is the exit from ruin? Because kwai, the word for blue, also describes my concepts of black and green, I attempt to reconcile these differing perspectives held captive in a word. In keen self-awareness of other, she, i.e. meaning, is the reckoning found inside irreconcilable, or the irreconcilable inside found reckoning, whichever it is, she, i.e. meaning, sometimes enters the mind from the outside, overstepping the insoluble, the wood-planked borders between meanings, as if one word or idea was or is more or less active in the mouth, the mind, or in protest or pronoun, as if any idea can fit inside the carcass-like casket of label. I read that we categorize to create meaning, therefore, it is possible to change meaning by recategorizing. Meaning hovers, a hummingbird moth, or is it the real thing? Which again is it, Trochilidae or Lahuni, the buzzing, long-beaked seeker of nectar that never seems to alight?
My very last question. What books are you currently reading, or what books would you want to recommend to our listeners?
Oh my God. So in terms of poetry, some of my favorite books of poems, I love D.G. Nenick Okpik's Corpse Whale and Layli Long Soldier's Whereas and Sherwin Bitsui's Flood Song. They're amazing poets. And in terms of, you know, non-poetry books, right now I'm reading Factfulness, which a friend of mine recommended, and it's very reminiscent of another book called The Better Angels of Our Nature that I wasn't quite interested in reading. I already know this stuff. But my friend Jeremy was like, you should read Factfulness. It's like very much for a lay audience that delivers data and statistics on the state of the world, which is constantly improving, which is a message I think people could stand to hear right now. So takes like the very long view of humanity.
Thank you, Heather, so much for joining us tonight. This was a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed chatting about all of it. So thank you.
Thank you.
The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Beth Ann Ostein. Look for more information about Heather and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. I'm Lauren Korn, and this has been The Right Question.